The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Howdy, partners. I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm your Swedish masseuse, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 78 of The Big Picture for the week beginning September 25. And coming up on today's show, the newest kids' cartoon feature finally lets us know where babies come from. Or does it?
It's time to drop the beat with MC Marky Mark as he reviews The Get Down.
And saddle up for the full show because we'll be riding off into the sunset with Hollywood's latest remake, The Magnificent Seven.
MC Marky Mark. Finally, we announce on air, Mark, you're on The Big Picture. We've been going for a long time. We haven't let people know you're actually a rapper.
Well, in my spare time, I like to do presents.
You like to do...
I'm also a dad.
Yeah, you should write some great raps around that. We're going to get to why you're a rapper real soon when you talk about The Get Down. Before all that, though, and before we get to our first review, Storks, here's a little bit of information about what else is happening this week, including Snowden. You reviewed this on last week's show. Go to thebigpicturewebsite.com to listen to Mark's thoughts on this new film directed by Oliver Stone, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the real-life CIA whistleblower Edward Snowden. It's a tech security thriller and chiller. It's available now at thebigpicturewebsite.com. That's Mark's review, but the film is at cinemas now. Go check it out.
And Tuesday this week, 8:30 p.m. on the ABC, the documentary Conviction airs. It's an intense and kind of riveting study of what it takes to solve a high-profile and emotionally charged murder. It's told through the eyes of the homicide detectives who brought Jill Meagher's killer to justice. And so the whole idea is basically seeing what actually goes. If you like police procedural dramas, you'll actually see what happens as far as cops are concerned.
On DVD and Blu-ray and that kind of stuff this week, one of Mark's favourite films of this year, Hunt for the Wilder People. It's a New Zealand family comedy romp about a boy, his quote-unquote uncle, and what happens when they're on the run. Hunt for the Wilder People, out now, available in your home. And check out Mark's review, thebigpicturewebsite.com, for his thoughts on that movie.
And speaking of some of my favourite films, this is not. It's kind of more of a public service announcement. PlayStation and Apple Tunes this week have finally released 2012, starring John Cusack, Amanda Peet, Oliver Platt, and Woody Harrelson, to just name a few. It's that action-focused drama about the end of the world, according to Mayan prophecy and so forth. And it's got US presidents, and it's got planes falling away, and it's got all that sort of stuff. And if you think it should add up to a good film, it doesn't. So just be careful. 2012's out there. Don't let anybody fool you.
I was about to fool everyone and say, I completely disagree. That film was great.
Unbelievable.
And I'm glad you brought it to my attention. I'm going to go watch it again.
Can I just spoil the ending for everyone?
Please don't.
Okay.
What I'm about to do, though, is talk about something that happened in entertainment news this week that isn't to do with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt's private life. That was everywhere this week.
I
so
know.
What you might have missed is that in the world of Hollywood, where there always seems to be something to be revamped, well, the newest one coming our way, we think, is Jumanji.
They're
going to redo Jumanji. That film that was out in 1995, pretty successful. Robin Williams, Kirsten Dunst were in it, about this kind of rollicking adventure film that had a mysterious board game with unimaginable powers. Well, now Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart, who this year were together in Central Intelligence, are teaming up for a new version, which apparently is a continuation of the 1995 film, not a remake, not a rehash.
The board games turned up again.
A recontinuation, I don't know, something like that. And also, you'd like this. Karen Gillan from the latest Doctor Who series is also going to be in this new version of Jumanji.
Let's pause for a moment and just contemplate her excellent career.
Good, great. I'm going to move forward and just say Jumanji is going to be out in July 2017.
Okay, well, something else is coming out quite soon and is actually pretty exciting for me. You know, Stephen King is basically one of the best writers on the planet. I don't know if you actually most people associate him with horror and that sort of fiction, that sort of thing, but he actually writes quite broadly. And his famous novella, Hearts in Atlantis, has received a personal nod of approval by the celebrated author for adaptation into TV and film.
It was made as a movie years ago by Scott Hicks, the Australian director, and Anthony Hopkins started in the film. Are they making a new TV version of it?
They are, and it's called Hearts, and it's set in 1966, and it tells the sort of bittersweet coming of age story about a group of college boys and their first time away from home and their obsessions and self-destruction and what it means to live in an adult world. Well, look, it's coming along very soon, and so that's something I figure I'll certainly be looking out. Production and casting will start in early 2017.
All right, Mark, we're almost at what your kids are watching this week, our choice for that review segment, which is the new animated film Storks. Before we get there, though, I've got a true or false statement to pose to you, because very soon we're going to be talking about The Get Down, this new TV series that Baz Luhrmann is behind, very famous Australian director. One of the films that Baz Luhrmann made is Australia. Now, Mark, true or false, the stars of that film... This isn't the true or false bit. The stars of the film are Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman. But on set, true or false, did Hugh Jackman save Nicole Kidman from a poisonous scorpion on the set of that movie? True or false?
Wow, okay. In Northern Australia, right?
Mm.
Okay.
Mm.
Yeah, I think I got a theory on that. I'm looking forward to it. Okay, true or false after the preview?
After we talk about storks.
Okay. Well, where do babies come from? Now, please, before you sort of write in for us, because we do have the little book that Mum gave us, that's one of those questions, though, which every parent knows will one day be asked, and they fear the day that it will basically happen. In What Your Kids Are Watching segment this week, we're looking at the new animated movie Storks, and it offers parents a kind of ready-made answer of sorts. But what else does it deliver, and should we take delivery?
In the beginning, storks delivered babies. It wasn't always easy. No matter how tough or impossible or brutal or inhumane or savage, we would triumph over adversity. Thank goodness we don't do that anymore. Now storks deliver packages for cornerstore.com.
That's right, Mark. Basically, the storyline for Storks, which is from the animation studio that brought us the Lego movie. Storks, as we heard in that clip, is about how storks used to deliver babies. Now they deliver packages. That's where Storks flies from that point.
To be honest, it actually sounds like a kind of pretty weak premise. Is there much going in this film?
Not really. I'm struggling to find really...
It's a cartoon about FedEx.
Nice things to say about storks. It's got a very big vocal cast in this. Everyone from Kelsey Grammer of Frasier fame to Jennifer Aniston from Friends and Ty Burrell from Modern Family. And Andy Samberg is on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, all these big voices in this film. But it's a little bit just, like, it doesn't have very far to go. So, yes, the premise is weak. Storks deliver babies, now deliver packages. But then somehow we get an orphaned human who works with the storks in cahoots with one of the lead storks. And they eventually have to deliver a baby to a family. And then what happens from there is basically what happens in most other animated adventures. There's an adventure.
Hijinks.
And hijinks. And they've got to take something to at the end point.
You know, you don't sound very thrilled about this
storyline. No, mate, I'm not. I went to a preview of this with a lot of kids in the audience. And I barely heard laughter. This is a full cinema. Barely heard laughter. This is a film, I think, that flogs dead horses constantly. There's a lot of jokes and repeated jokes that come up. They weren't that funny to begin with, and they keep going with those jokes, and it just makes them lamer and lamer and lamer as they go on. Also, and this is coming from a guy who also likes to speak very quickly. I don't mind like talking like 100 miles an hour. This movie goes at about 100 million thousand miles an hour. It just is frantic and frenetic and barely like has room to breathe and stop. Almost as if it's so desperate to distract you and to somehow equate that if it does heaps of things at once, it's going to be entertaining. It tries that on, and then really when you sit back and reflect on what's actually happening, there's not much there.
There's not much going.
It's just a bit of noise, really, that's going on, and colour.
What about the educational side? I mean, like, I guess it sort of sets itself up to answer the question, where do babies come from? Is there anything kind of educational for kids?
Thankfully, Storks isn't trying to in any way suggest that babies do come from storks. It does use that premise, but does swiftly kind of fly away from it as quickly as possible, and just uses it basically as a lark. As a lark for the rest of the adventure that follows. There is one kind of awkward conversation between a son and his parents about where do babies come from that will remind some parents of the conversation that they have had with their kids or the one that they know they're going to have at some point. But in contrast to a recent movie like Kubo and the Two Strings, it's nowhere near as provocative or includes as many themes, deep thinking, thoughtful themes as Kubo had. Kubo had everything from grief to worship of ancestors. Storks, kind of suggests that it's going to wade into this deep territory of where do babies come from, but Nah, it doesn't.
Okay, well, is there anything positive to say about the production? Just before people who are actually tearing up their free invites or something?
Yeah, look, I wish I could say more. It feels really bad as an adult having a go at an animated film. I know they're for kids.
Sure,
but hey,
we'll poke kittens after this, but yeah.
I won't. Maybe that's you. But look, given I was in an audience full of kids and they weren't really responding to this film, I feel on safe ground to say Storks, even though it's from the same studio that brought Lego Movie, isn't a great piece of work. The most positive thing I can say is that there's a storyline going through the film that's a very good reminder of spending quality time with your kids. The reason that this stork and this human orphan has to deliver a baby to a human family is because a little boy wants a brother or sister. And as a result of that, he ends up getting his parents involved in kind of preparing the way for the storks. So Storks does provide a great reminder of relationships and the value of those and how it's really important to invest in them. It's not trying to persuade us to that or even leave us thinking that, but that's the most positive thing I can take away from the film. A great reminder that that like human life is all about relationships. And if you think about God being the author of relationships and he wants us to invest in them and he wants us to invest in each other and helping each other be the best person they can be, well, then Storks kind of, you know, sends you on that journey, but really it's best to go off in other directions and explore how you can invest in your own family and in the best that they can be. I wouldn't be going to answers from Storks.
Wow. Storks. Spend time with your kids, but possibly not watching this film. Mm. Okay, so Storks stars the vocal stylings of Andy Samberg, Kelsey Grammer, Ty Burrell, and Jennifer Aniston. It was delivered to cinemas everywhere last Thursday, September 22nd, and is rated G for some scenes may scare very young children, probably the threat of finding out where they come from. You know, in a kind of really G-rated way.
Mm. Now, Mark, coming up real soon, you're going to be talking about The Get Down, this TV series that Baz Luhrmann is behind. Here's a true or false statement to do with Baz Luhrmann and his film Australia. On the set of that movie, did Hugh Jackman save Nicole Kidman from a poisonous scorpion? True or false?
Now, I'm going to go yes, because I figure that Hugh would do that. Hugh's a stand-up guy. He wouldn't just watch the scorpion.
I don't disagree with you, Mark, but it's false.
Oh.
Because it was actually Nicole Kidman that saved Hugh Jackman from a poisonous scorpion on the set.
Yeah.
She was about to join Hugh in some intimate scene involving a sleeping bag, and she noticed a poisonous scorpion was crawling on his leg, and she was the one that went to Hugh Wolverine's rescue.
Yeah, well, she took no nonsense from Tom Cruise, and she'd be taking any nonsense from scorpions.
I will make no link between Tom Cruise and scorpions as you just did.
Okay. Well, still coming up on the show, we have a stack of stuff, including Turn the Beat Around. I hope you hang around for that particular song, one of my favorites. The Get Down with Baz Luhrmann, and of course, our own interview with a hip hop artist to tell you everything you need to know about that genre.
Welcome back to the show. Mark, is it time for MC Marky Mark to the mic?
Almost, but not quite. Oh. Later in the show, we'll be taking a look at the new Baz Luhrmann-inspired TV show, The Get Down. But since it's a show about a musical phenomenon, before we get there, we thought it'd be a good idea to devote our soundtrack segment for this week to the beat behind the treats. See? Anyway.
Oh, is that just a sample
of what could be coming. Okay, so here's a musical taster in the form of Vicky Sue Robinson's Turn the Beat Around.
To hear percussion, turn it upside down.
Turn the Beat Around has become something of a disco anthem, which is actually strange for a song that no one wanted. You know, it was originally written by Joel and Peter Jackson, the brothers behind the largely unknown band Touch of Class, but the label releasing their debut album knocked it back, saying, "We don't like that one, the lyrics move too fast, you have that jungle beat in there, it's not happening."
What kind of feedback is that?
I know.
Jungle beat happening. Yeah, just, too fast, you're
you be,
out.
You be taking that too funky stuff out of here. You know, so that's what.
Get out with your funk.
Yeah, so the Jackson brothers gave it to the girlfriend of a sound engineer who'd been working on the album, who happened to be Vicky Sue Robinson.
Oh.
Okay. So she recorded her voice track in one take, and the song went to number 10 on the Billboard pop charts. Talk about missed opportunities. It makes it a perfect choice of Baz Luhrmann's The Get Down, a show about a world making its transition from disco to rap.
Are you down with all things hip and hop? Can you tell the difference between rap and, well, stuff that's just someone talking fast with a beat in the background? Then you're almost certainly the audience Netflix had in mind when it made The Get Down. The beat-driven Baz Luhrmann creation is a fictional insight into the arrival of hip-hop on planet Earth. It also chronicles the last days of disco, as Mark just mentioned, and the distant rumblings of punk, but underneath is a mythic story of a prince and his princess and the drive to help truth survive in the heart of a capitalist hive, yo.
With just a little courage, you could really be something.
I got courage. Let's take a trip back. Back in the time, 1977. It was maximum crime.
You're a natural wordsmith, man.
You're working for drug dealers.
You ever thought of quitting?
This ain't Disneyland, this is the Bronx.
Dream right, but it seemed like nothing found me but trouble. I see the light, it's right there at the end of the tunnel.
Y'all pushing me to be who you want me to be. Nobody's asking what I want to be.
Well, The Get Down is a musical drama television series set in the South Bronx in the late 1970s. And the key character is a guy called Ezekiel Zeke Figaro. He's basically played by Justice Smith, a smart teen with an amazing talent as a wordsmith who's determined to move beyond just the sort of world that the rest of the kids of his age are accepting. And he's in love with Mylene, the local Latino preacher's daughter. Now, Mylene has her own talent. She has this massive voice, and she has her own dreams, too, of becoming a disco queen and getting out of the Bronx. She certainly has the pipes to achieve this, but she's got some real barriers to overcome. One is a puritanical father, okay, and the other is the fact that Zeke lacks the ambition to leave. He wants to make something within the Bronx, and she wants to leave the Bronx. So we have star-crossed lovers once again, and here's our story unfolding. But music is the key to all their dreams, and before long, the Grandmaster Flash turns up to lend a hand.
Oh, Grandmaster Flash, that is the birth of hip-hop. Now, Mark, you just mentioned star-crossed lovers. What triggered in my mind is Romeo and Juliet,
of course,
Baz Luhrmann made a movie version of. We've been going on throughout the show up until this point. Now we're talking about The Get Down. We've been saying that Baz Luhrmann is involved, so Mark, MC Marky Mark, if I can call you that. What's Baz Luhrmann's connection to The Get Down? You haven't mentioned that yet.
No, well, apparently Baz Luhrmann spent 10 years dreaming up this concept and working out how it was going to play out in a 6-part series. It's actually a really interesting production idea because Baz isn't any way tied to episode duration lengths. You know, you sit down and you go, okay, is this an hour-long show? Is it a half-hour-long show? You have no idea. This thing is 6 episodes. Some of them are 45 minutes. Some of them are an hour and a half. Some of them are not, you know, it's just really random.
Yeah.
He's telling a story and just following an arc, 6 little arcs, one after another.
Oh, so he's written and directed it and behind it
all? He's behind it all, but he doesn't direct every single episode.
Okay.
Okay, so what he does is he directs the first episode and you can see his fingerprints all over the tone of it, but it's not, some of the key episodes are actually directed by Ed Bianchi. You might remember him from The Wire.
Yes, I do,
yeah,
my
Generation
friend.
Kill,
yes,
Boardwalk
I do.
Empire.
Okay. Yeah, all of those shows.
So you've got an interesting meld between Baz Luhrmann's fantastical creativity and Ed Bianchi's sort of very straightforward realism. It's a beautiful mix.
Wow, a mix of The Wire and Moulin Rouge. Who would have thought it? Now, So I'm still a little bit confused though then about where or if there are Baz Luhrmann touches in this. And most people would know, even if they haven't seen his movies for a long time, they know Strictly Ballroom, Moulin Rouge, Australia, Romeo and Juliet, Great Gatsby. They know the kind of look and feel of Baz Luhrmann stuff. So is the Get Down like that, even if he's not directing it?
What you're really talking about is the surreal nature of Baz Luhrmann stuff, isn't it? It's kind of the weird moment where the entire cast bursts into song or you know, absinthe fairies fly down and affect the plot. And that's not there, okay? There's a real strong sense of what life must have been like in the 1970s throughout the Bronx. And interestingly, all the way through, you've got this sort of footage drawn from the period, archive footage, that sets the mood perfectly as to what people were struggling with and the tensions. But Baz Luhrmann is the master playwright here, because what he does is he does what he does in every film. He tells a fairy tale. There's always in a Baz Luhrmann film this whole sense of fairy tale.
That's a good way to summarize what he does. Yes.
Yeah. And so in this one, we've got the young black prince of the ghetto trying to make it. We've got ogre-like villains in terms of the people who control the local clubs and the drug scene. We've got a connection with his best paladin friend who happens to be the beat mixer.
What's a paladin?
Paladins are like the, in any sort of film, any sort of storyline where you have a knight,
yes,
you have his offsider, the guy who makes his knighthood possible, right?
Yeah.
His paladin.
Okay? That's a great crossword word. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Okay. And then you've got the princess, of course, of Mylene, and the quest that has to be won, the city that has to be conquered with music.
Okay, I've got two questions for you, Mark. One of them is, are you down with the Get Down?
I am so down. I should be on the floor.
Actually, no, now I've got another two questions. My question is, why are you down with the Get Down? And then I want to get back to this fairy tale idea. But before I get to that, why are you down with the Get Down?
Look, I'm pretty excited with it because visually, for a start, it's just fantastic to watch, okay? I mean, it is like most things that Baz Luhrmann does. Musically and visually, it can be incredible. If anything, Baz Luhrmann, if he's ever let down, it's his storylines. But this one seems to be right on the money. It's incredibly well written. Look, you've got to be careful too, by the way. There is some sexuality and things that sort of push him because of the 70s. Obviously, there's some drug references and violence and language because we're talking about South Bronx in a very difficult period. But I don't think that just in any way obscures the fact that this is a great television production. Let me go out on a limb. Possibly the best TV production I've seen this year. I watch a lot of TV, and this is really good. This is compelling.
You mentioned it's a fairy tale. You can summarize it as a fairy tale, but does it have a fairy tale meaning behind it then?
Yeah, I guess in most fairy tales, there's always going to be a goal to the end of the story arc, okay? And in this one, there's a kingdom to be won and there's a truth to be exposed. And in this case, the kingdom that's to be won is basically it's Ezekiel's place at the top of the wrapping food chain, you know, alongside Grandmaster Flash and the rest of the guys, you know. So there's a start. But there's also a truth to be exposed, the idea that the world would prefer to look away and not see the problems of what's going on, than rather be happy in the moment than see where their lifestyle is taking them. So forever, in every sort of episode, begins with this idea of the end of the story, so to speak. In every episode, you see Zeke arguably 10 years on, looking back and saying, now, where was this taking us all? Where was this taking us all? And I think that for me is the sort of Christian question that I always want to ask myself, both as a parent, maybe as a worker, or even just as a friend. What am I doing now? And where is it taking me? Where am I going to land if I keep doing what I'm doing? Now, sometimes there's a positive answer to that. You go, this is where I want to be. But as a Christian, I've got to ask myself, sure, this looks like fun now, or I'm enjoying it, or this relationship is great, but where is it going to end? Am I going to arrive where I want to do? And for me, exposing the truth is kind of like where Baz Luhrmann takes us in The Get Down.
The Get Down is available anytime you like. It's on Netflix. With its non-specific adult rating, I'm still a bit confused by this, Mark, this whole non-specific adult rating, but you're sort of equating it with it warranting, what, an M for violence and language? There's a fair bit of sexual innuendo as well.
I've got to say, look, people, here's a fair warning. The same rating system that applies to TV and film does not apply to streaming. So we don't actually rate streaming programs the same way. There is no rating scale for us to go by. So in this case, we're going to say, hey, I've looked at the content. We're looking at an M.
And The Get Down also stars Justice Smith, Shameik Moore, and look out for Skylan Brooks, who was in Me, Earl and the Dying Girl. Great movie from last year. He turns up in this show as the voice of reason. Mark, before we get on to the rest of the show, just a quick pointer to, we also are not just available in the eardrums of people, but we're also available online. You can find us on Facebook at The Big Picture Show. Interact with us, share us, like us, do all that kind of stuff. The reviews and articles that we do every week, we post online. Get them out there to the masses and let the people dive into pop culture from a Christian perspective.
And if you want to see Ben's latest ironic t-shirt each week, you'll be able to see that just by watching the videos of the website. Okay, well, there's still to come. We have some fantastic stuff, including an interview with a hip-hop artist who tells you everything you need to know about a culture you probably know nothing about. Plus, wait for it, the Magnificent Seven.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Now, maybe you're not all up in the hood like Mark is, as he explained to us just before the break with the get down. You're so down with it. You're so down, Mark. That's it. There's nothing more to say about you now. You're just down. But maybe you don't really know your hip from your hop. What do you do if you lack the generational connection that makes Grandmaster Flash as easy to understand as beatboxing while you're popping? Well, you tune into The Big Picture, that's why. As regular listeners will know, we use our press record segment to source wisdom from others. And this week, we've invited on Nathan Kass, a.k.a. Disciple, who co-leads the Brisbane branch of a national cross-denominational hip-hop network called Crosswords. So in short, this guy knows about hip-hop. And he is about to tell us everything a Christian needs to know about the hip and the hop.
Basically, hip-hop is a culture, and out of that culture, it's got all these different elements. So you have rap, you got the DJ, you got the graffiti artist, and you got the breakdancer as well. So all those elements make up what hip-hop actually is. Freedom seem harder. The DJ is the person who looks after the music side of things, so you might have someone on stage who's sort of doing some scratching. You might have some person who's sort of beat juggling two records into each other. So they look after the music side of things, especially in the live element. Beatboxing is something that I can't do, and it's something where you actually use your mouth to make the beats. You might make the drum noise, the snare noise, the hi-hats, and all different noises nowadays. And it's an element that started off sort of connected to hip-hop, and now it's almost become its own thing. It's worldwide, yeah. MC stands for Master of Ceremonies, and basically that's the person on stage who has the mic and who's telling you everything. Breakdancing, so you got B-boys and you got B-girls, and breakdancing, you might have seen a little bit on TV, but it's a dance that broke out of hip-hop culture itself. So once again, head spins and back spins and all different kind of elements of breakdancing, yeah. Well, graffiti is the visual element of hip-hop itself as well. Within hip-hop, there's different crews and people who build their skills up together, and a lot of that can be seen in the graffiti scene. Hip-hop can greatly share the gospel because it's all about storytelling, it's all about experiences, and it's all about finding answers as well. So in any art form, whether it's breakdancing, whether it's graffiti, whether it's actually writing your raps and performing them, you can share your story with those around you, but also those who may just be listening to it on the other side as well. Never could lay down
that life like a martyr. That segment was provided courtesy of Eternity Digital, the online arm of Eternity Newspapers, one of our great supporters and also Australia's only national Christian news publication. And there's more where that came from. You can actually head over to Eternity Digital and you'll get some stuff from Kylie Minogue to Giving Sight to the Blind. Actually, it's a video format place now. So Christian radio host and Kylie Minogue impersonator Lucy Holmes reveals how helping people to see again is a wonderful gift that we can all give. Just one of the many videos available at Eternity Digital now. ...2016 is officially the year of the re.
The year of the re?
The reboot, the remake, the rehashes.
I see what's happening there, yes.
Yeah, at cinemas, we've had everything from a new version of Ghostbusters to the recent return of the Blair Witch Project, who knew why, The Jungle Book to Tarzan, Pete's Dragon to Zoolander 2, and another re settles up this week, the all-guns-blazing remake of the classic western The Magnificent Seven. Starring Denzel Washington and Jurassic World's Chris Pratt, the re-Magnificent Seven sets our sights again on standing up for the oppressed and our personal need for protection.
How many you got so far?
You and me.
Who's she?
We work for her.
Good Lord.
That's right.
That man murdered my husband.
I want something. I take it.
He will take everything we have.
So you seek revenge?
I seek righteousness, but I'll take revenge.
The Magnificent Seven, huge benchmark. Okay, how does it compare to the original?
In the world of Westerns, it sure is, Mark. Look, here's an admission from me. I don't think I've actually seen the original. But in my own
About to cock my imaginary Winchester.
And have a go. But in my own defense, I've seen the film that the original Magnificent Seven was based on.
Oh, okay.
So there's a Japanese film from the 50s called Seven Samurai that was then ripped off by Hollywood as the Magnificent Seven in 1960. And that's probably more famous to most people than Magnificent Seven, but it did originally come from Seven Samurai. I've seen Seven Samurai. I love that movie. I think it's fantastic. And what happened with when it was taken to the Magnificent Seven and put in a Western context as opposed to a samurai one that you get in Seven Samurai, the main difference is basically you've just been transported across to America, but the same premise is there in that Magnificent Seven from 1960, and it's the same with the Magnificent Seven now in 2016, which is a bunch of gunslingers, a bunch of rogues, a bunch of Western outlaws are banded together because they're hired by a small town to protect them from a bad guy who is basically sending an army in to rip them off left, right, and center. To basically pillage their village, they get some gunslingers in to protect them.
Right. So, you know, we love sort of a film that actually makes people think about the deeper moral questions. And this is basically a plot about standing up for the oppressed. It seems pretty straightforward.
It is, but it doesn't really force that on us, I don't think, as a viewer. Look, having not seen the original, but hearing a lot about it, and the original had Steve McQueen, Yul Brynner, Charles Bronson, and the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly's Eli Wallach. They were massive stars in the 1960s. And that film's known very well for its charisma and banter and basically just being this excellent version of excellent take on a mainstream Western. This new version, I can see why they wanted to do it. They got a really good cast: Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, who starred with Denzel Washington in Training Day, and the director of that film, Anton Fuqua, is the guy behind this film. So there's a lot going on here that's to recommend it in terms of who's behind the camera, who's in front of it, and what you'd expect is a big explosion of special effects, of coolness, of one-liners, of a lot of charisma and banter and that sort of thing. I didn't really get that from this new Magnificent Seven. It's not a terrible film. It's enjoyable. I think they use the Western landscape excellently. You get those big panorama shots. You get the showdowns. You get guys chewing on those little cigars that Clint Eastwood made famous.
Cigarillos
in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You get all of that. But what I don't think you get is a storyline that really rattles along. Even though it's quite simple, and as you said, it is about standing up for the oppressed. That does come through, but it doesn't really push it along, and neither do all the performances. I just expected a little bit more in terms of an explosion of everything from more of a sense of humor, more of banter, more on-screen dynamics. When you've got seven lead cast members brought together as a posse, you really kind of expect that you're going to see a bit more light and shade. That's up there. You do get that, but not as vividly as I think you'd anticipate when you're going to remake something like this.
So you got your main arc, but no real sort of mini arcs between characters.
There's really not much time spent on the individual characters themselves. I mean, you don't need to know too much about their motivation. And back in Seven Samurai, and I presume in the original Magnificent Seven, there wouldn't have been too much in there about motivation. Apart from, you do get the sort of whiff going through of guys who do bad stuff, trying to do good stuff, effectively seeking a bit of redemption. You get redemption in there. You also get revenge, as the clip that we played a little bit earlier demonstrates. There is a big through line in this film of basically being motivated by revenge, but also under the umbrella effectively of righteousness, or what a lot of characters in the film seem to describe as a way to live a godly life. This film, I was amazed at how much God stuff goes on in it, but I shouldn't really be, given back in what, the 1870s, when this was set in America, most people either were Christian or at least associated themselves with being Christian. So it shouldn't be a huge surprise that Magnificent Seven is awash with biblical ideas and pictures and quotes.
Okay, well, look, I guess speaking of one which is probably not a terribly biblical idea, we're not actually going to go out and solve our problems by hiring a gunman.
Okay, so if anybody, I'm glad you cleared that up.
Yeah, so if anybody was thinking for a moment the big picture would actually authorize that or recommend it, this is not our stated
policy.
And
I don't think the Magnificent Seven either is trying to force you down that path.
Good, well, that's fair. That's good. But is there something about the idea of finding protection outside of yourself?
There is, but again, I'm not sure that the movie itself is giving us this. So we can go as a viewer and think more about that. And I think it definitely comes through just in the basic premise, the setup, that this town gets all its money together, goes out, hires some gunslingers because it cannot defend itself against what's coming towards it. But then as far as us walking out of cinema and thinking about, does that mean that we need protection outside of ourselves? I think you'd only walk away thinking about that
if you're a Christian film reviewer.
If you're a Christian film reviewer and you already recognize that, yes, we do need that. But saying that, throughout The Magnificent Seven, there is a lot of commentary and a lot of talk about people being God-fearing people or a God-fearing man, or there's sort of a threat of judgment, not just in this life, but the one after. It's not necessarily explicitly said, but you get everything in here from people quoting the Lord's Prayer to Psalm 23, the very famous "When I walk in the valley of the shadow of death." The church is at the center of this town. There's a lot of time given to the preacher. There's shots of sermons and people praying and all kinds of things. There's a lot of pointers to the fact that we may need protection from something outside ourselves. We may not even know what it is, but we know that we should go to God for it. And so I think all of that's in Magnificent Seven. You may only start bringing all that together if you sit there and piece those pieces together yourselves, or maybe you're a Christian reviewer on a show like The Big Picture and you walk away thinking, oh, this kind of indicates that we need to protect ourselves from something outside ourselves, and we can't do that ourselves. Maybe we need God or Jesus. Yeah.
Or you'll just enjoy the gunfire.
Enjoy the gunfire.
The Magnificent Seven stars Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, and at least four other Magnificents. It opens this coming Thursday, September 29, and is rated M for violence.
For another take on the Magnificent... yeah, who knew? M for violence. For another take on the Magnificent Seven, head across to the Insights website. Like Eternity that Mark mentioned a little bit earlier in the show, Insights is a supporter of The Big Picture. We also support what they do, insights.uca.org.au. Russ Matthews' review of The Magnificent Seven is up and running. Check it out. Now, Mark, you just mentioned before that the Bible doesn't actually talk about doing what The Magnificent Seven does do. Or does it? Because after the break, we are going to ask that big question of Bible Society CEOs Greg Clark. What does the Bible have to say about hitmen before you give us the top five hired guns? Welcome back to the show. Now, just before the break, we took a look at the remake of the classic Western, The Magnificent Seven.
And it was magnificent.
It was. The film,
well,
maybe
our,
not so
our
much.
Review.
What we said about the film review. And if you missed it, but you're listening to the podcast right now, you just need to rewind it. And if you're not listening to the podcast, you can always find the podcast at thebigpicturewebsite.com. And that's where they're all housed. So either find Magnificent Seven or another one. Anyway, I'm digressing off the topic because what I want to get into is a question that The Magnificent Seven raises, Mark. Now, you might never have asked yourself this. Have you ever thought if it's reasonable or unreasonable to hire seven heavy hitters to take care of your problems? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, I'm thinking to myself now.
Yeah, and I'm sure as you think about that, the same when I think about that, that's a question that's far too fraught with difficulty for us to answer. So it's another chance to saddle up with Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark to answer the question, what does the Bible have to say about hiring a hitman?
Do not suppose that I've come to bring peace to the earth, said Jesus. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. These are the surprising words of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 10, verse 34. Well, it's a basic question of many books and movies. It's the simple plot line. A town is living in peace, then a bad guy comes and disturbs that peace, and the town has to work out how to get rid of him. Or her, although it has to be admitted it is usually a him. And this narrative shape, as the critics call it, from peace to chaos and then back to peace again, transposes itself rather nicely onto life. You're born into hope. Childhood, at least for many of us, is a time of dreams and games and happiness. And then the world starts to close in on us. A family breaks down, a parent dies, your house gets broken into, your toys get stolen. You yourself start to choose disobedience or deception or dishonour. And the rosy picture of utopia gets pretty smudged until it's hard to recognise. But you long to get back to that sense of wondrous freedom and playfulness and goodness that you glimpsed in childhood. The feeling that everything could be all right, and the monsters and the devils and the sources of harm might be vanquished for good. Well, it's a shame that many people don't at that point automatically think of Christianity as the answer to their quest. Because that is a terrific way of describing how the Christian story unfolds. We probably need to do a better job of describing Jesus as a divine warrior, a kind of hitman against evil. It may sound odd, but that's what he was. Jesus came to fight for your future. He came, as the Bible verse tells us, with a sword. He may be the Prince of Peace, as we sing in the Christmas carols, but the way to peace involved a clash, a conflict, a takedown. Which is where the superhero films and comics get it right. There is a cosmic showdown between good and evil, and there are agents working for both sides. But in reality, the time frame of these books and movies is all wrong. Christian faith teaches that this battle has already taken place. The bad guys have been vanquished, and we are just now in the clean-up mode, waiting for them to retreat, whimpering with their tails between their legs. The event of this battle was the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth back in the first century. And the biblical explanation of the meaning of that event is that by dying as an innocent man, a perfect sacrifice for the sins of humanity, Jesus, the God-man, took on the forces of darkness and sin and evil and won. We know he won because he did something no other human being has done, but every superhero character understands. He returned triumphant from the grave. I love the fact that these storylines still get people excited in the movies. But I'm more excited when people pick up that these stories are built on a story that actually happened in history just 2,000 years ago, when the greatest human being of all took on death and defeated it. Your task for now, should you accept it, is to work out what it means to follow in his footsteps.
Ah, Ben, we've reached that moment in the show which I look forward to every week, the top five. And this week in our top five, we've been magnificently inspired by the Magnificent Seven. I feel certain I'll be hiring my own personal posse to protect my garbage bins from whoever is keeping filling them with that extra stuff every Tuesday, now that I've actually watched a film like that.
Weren't you listening to what Greg Clark just said?
Honestly... I feel that I've just been given license. Well,
right,
we'll move
right
on.
Okay. So how does this inform the top five list this week then? I'm a little bit concerned now.
Well, the Magnificent Seven reminded us that getting in heavy hitters is nothing new for Hollywood, okay? I mean, movies in general for that matter. You remind us of the Seven Samurai. Well, the most excellent seven are themselves, a ripoff. So if the concept has been used time and time again, I figure we can actually look down memory lane and find my top five films that call in the heavy hitters.
Five.
I'm going to start with the obvious, okay? You know, that same plot line where you need someone who's really, really good with a gun to do something about your problems. And so I thought I might as well point in a nod to The Seven Samurai, I'd nod to The Last Samurai, 2003. Tom Cruise, directed by Ed Zwick, Ken Watanabe and Billy Connolly, of all other people. A story about a war hero who's proved remarkably effective in killing off one indigenous population in the American Indian Wars, now hired to knock off samurai who are not ready to embrace the future. So I figured that's a nice start for all those films where you've got a guy and a gun and he's going to solve your problem.
A nice place to start on a list of high hitters. For the record, we here at The Big Picture do not endorse people doing any of the like of these movies that are being suggested, do we, Mark?
No, we leave that up to Craigslist.
Okay. Please move on to number four quickly.
Well, now we get a little bit twisty, okay? You've got that idea of bringing in the heavy hitter. Well, in Predators 2010, we saw a really interesting take on that idea because, it's a film about a group of mercenaries, soldiers, criminals, drug lords, assassins, psychopaths who are the real heavy hitters, and they wake up in a jungle on a foreign planet one day and realize they've been brought in all right, but just to be the sport, so to speak.
This is one of the many sequels in the Predator franchise, right?
That's so right.
The movies from the 80s that Arnold Schwarzenegger was in.
And I would arguably say it's probably the best of all the Predator films. Oh, except for the original. Okay.
Yeah,
the original
concept film.
Like, it's a really interesting take on Predators. So Adrian Brody puts on 25 pounds of muscle to turn up and basically be a bad guy in a film. It's a really interesting take on that whole idea of bringing the heavy hitter, but this time not so much as the salvation, but the sport.
Three.
Let's get even more twisty. There are lots of different ways you can actually bring in heavy hitters, and they don't have to have anything to do with guns. Heard of a little film like Up in the Air?
Oh, I think I can see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
I really like that movie.
Jason Reitman directed it, stars George Clooney, Vera Farmiga, and Anna Kendrick. The whole idea of a downsizing expert played by Clooney to be brought in to help a troubled workforce through the most vulnerable time, redundancy.
He's the hired gun.
He's the hired gun. He's the guy who comes in. A large amount of people were actually fired. A large amount of the people who we see fired in the film are not actually actors, by the way, but people who were recently laid off. So the filmmakers thought that was a great idea to bring them in and use their experience.
Oh, I was going to say, this is like a backhanded compliment. We got you a new job. It's you reliving the anguish that you just went through of being fired.
Apparently, you've just had your guts torn out. Why don't you do that on camera for
us? On camera for a few bucks.
There you go.
So they did.
Number two, number one, these are big toss-ups for me. If you're going to bring in heavy hitters, if you're going to bring people who are actually going to solve the problem, then, you know, I thought, look, this one almost made it to number one. In 2010, Christopher Nolan did a little film called Inception.
Okay? Oh, yeah, you may have heard of that.
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Ellen Page and Tom Hardy all star in this amazing bring in the heavy hitter, the master dream thief, if you like, sent in to a target's subconscious, not to steal but to plant an idea. And in an effort to combat the confusion, you know, it was just an idea of a story within story within story, and it's probably one of the most amazing scripts, you know, ever written. It's really, really worth it.
That's a big call. Now we're prompting people to think, is it reasonable to sort out your problems by hiring a professional dream thief to implant an idea into someone's head? Is that reasonable or unreasonable? You decide.
But there are so many little layers within this, as in he goes down one dream and another dream and another dream and that sort of stuff, that in the Japanese broadcast of this, they decided that it was important to put in the upper left-hand corner of the screen a reminder to the viewers as to which level of the story they were in. Okay, so it is a bit confusing, but well worth seeing.
One.
Okay, there is no heavy hitter more ultimate in all of fiction, brought in when everyone else has failed to make a case. Scotland Yard's last recourse, yes, Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, you're going for Sherlock Holmes as the big hired gun.
He is the final hired gun for every mystery. You know, many people will think of the great stories that Sherlock Holmes has solved. I think there's no case more baffling or infamous than The Hound of the Baskervilles. You know, no less than 12 movies, 2 miniseries, and countless TV episodes were made since 1921 on this one story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. I know, 12 movies. I mean, seriously.
That's
talk about the remake of remakes.
I know, talk about the year of the re. Wow.
I know, okay. Many people will point to Basil Rathbone or Benedict Cumberbatch as the most famous Sherlocks to have gone hunting the hound, but my personal favourite for this story is Peter Cushing in the 1959 version of the story. And I think it's just because the entire film is an incredible exercise in melodrama. Okay, and if I can't prove that any other way, I'm going to do it by playing this trailer.
The greatest story ever written by one of the world's greatest storytellers, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's classic masterpiece of mystery, suspense, and horror, The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Some revolting sacrificial rite has been performed. Depths a human being can sink to.
What human being could have done this?
That is precisely what I intend to find out.
But how can you be so certain that somebody took one of the bishop's spiders and deliberately placed it in Sir Henry's room? That it wasn't in the luggage he brought from South Africa?
Elementary, my dear Watson. There are no tarantulas in South Africa.
Mark, you promised melodrama and that clip delivered it.
And I just want to point out that with the death of video stores, it's almost impossible to find the 1959 version now, unless, of course, you Google it on YouTube. I'm not saying anything about that, but, you know, it's a real, the real tragedy is actually the loss of video stores because streaming services don't replace everything.
And so. Nor, as we come to the end of the show, do we recommend people follow the actions of the Magnificent Seven and hired guns.
Unless, of course, they're Sherlock Holmes. That'd be all right.
Oh, mate, we've come to the end of the show. We've got to move on. Otherwise, we're going to get in too deep too quickly. What is coming up on the show next week?
Well, the next big thing in kids' books to film, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. That's quite the peculiar title. We're also going to take a look at Life Animated, a documentary that presents Disney as a cure for mental illness.
And Deepwater Horizon, the environmental disaster, now a superhero film, bursting into flame at a cinema near you.
Yeehaw, I will be Ben McKechnie next week.
I'll be Mark Hadley. See you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.